This time on your weekly constitutional.
Both the president and his severest critics have embraced this identification of Trump with Jackson, though for exactly opposite reasons. What Donald Trump said is, I'm just like Andrew Jackson. I'm beloved by the people, hated by the elites, loved in the hinterlands, hated in Washington, and I'm going to go to Washington and do battle for the common people against the insiders. His critics, admitting none of those specifics, have, however, said, yes, you are just like Andrew Jackson. You racist, bigot, ignoramus, tyrant.
It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's a presidential smackdown. Andrew Jackson versus Donald Trump.
It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
I was recently speaking to my executive producer, Wayne Winkler, and we were both sort of stunned to realize that we've been producing this show, your weekly constitutional, for 9 years, almost a decade now, in the studios of WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee. But we've had wonderful relationships with other public radio stations over the years, and I'm glad to say that I've long had a great relationship with WUOT at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where currently I work and teach. Recently, I had the pleasure of going over to UOT and interviewing a historian from the University of Tennessee on a subject I think you'll find quite fascinating.
My name is Dan Feller, and I am a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and also editor and director of the papers of Andrew Jackson.
Wow. Very, very impressive. And you were telling me just before we sat down, Dan, that you are going to be segueing out of here in a little while and hitting the retirement trail.
Yes, but that's a little bit off in the future still.
A little bit off in the future, so we can't bury you quite yet.
I have no intention that you will ever bury me.
All right. Well, I'm happy to know, as you told me, that you'll be sticking around for a while and you're going to be working on other projects here at UT, so we look forward to having you back on the show. Regular listeners will recall that Dan was on several years ago, I think it was 2017, and we were talking about Andrew Jackson. In fact, we went into a two-part series on Andrew Jackson because Dan knows more about Andrew Jackson than anybody else I know, and all of it was fascinating. So that, if you want a complete overview of Jackson's life in 2 hours, go back to our podcast site and simply enter the search bar, Jackson, and you will find those episodes very quickly. Today, however, our focus is a little bit different. What's our focus today, Dan?
I think we're going to talk about Andrew Jackson and Donald Trump.
Exactly. In fact, you and I have bumped into each other at the National History Day competition, which both of us judge, and perhaps at one or two other places. And each time, you mentioned to me how many people are making comparisons between our current president and Old Hickory, and how you don't particularly agree with most of them. So take it away.
Well, let's start about with the comparisons. President Trump, and before that, candidate Trump, embraced Andrew Jackson. I think everybody knows this, as his model. Once he became president, he put that portrait of Andrew Jackson right above his desk in the Oval Office so that you see that portrait in every photo op. At the Hermitage in March 2017, I was there for this. He embraced Andrew Jackson, said in almost these words, I'm just like Andrew Jackson. And he had been saying that in his campaign, had been saying that beforehand.
Let me interject. The Hermitage, for those who don't know, is Jackson's home. And it's just to the east, right? The east of Nashville.
It's on the east side of Nashville. And the occasion that President Trump was there for, this was again March 2017, so his presidency was only several weeks old. The occasion was Andrew Jackson's 250th birthday.
Yeah.
Now, it is worthy of note that they have a little birthday celebration every year at the Hermitage, and the sitting president of the United States is always invited to attend. The last president who had taken them up on that invitation was Ronald Reagan, and the last president of Andrew Jackson's own Democratic Party who had taken them up on that invitation was Lyndon Johnson. So this is not a routine stop on the presidential itinerary.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump made a point of going to the Hermitage. What was interesting to me to observe then and since is that both the president and his severest critics, largely in the media, have embraced this identification of Trump with Jackson, though for exactly opposite reasons. What Donald Trump said, and he said it very explicitly at the Hermitage, and he has said it elsewhere, is, I'm just like Andrew Jackson. I'm beloved by the people, hated by the elites. I'm a great popular hero, loved in the hinterlands, hated in Washington, and I am going to go to Washington to do battle for the common people against the insiders.
Well, no, superficially, that's sounding reasonable at this point.
Well, let's get into that.
Okay.
But his critics, admitting none of those specifics, have, however, said, and they've said this abundantly, yes, you are just like Andrew Jackson. You racist, bigot, ignoramus, tyrant, you.
Mm-hmm.
And so both sides have embraced enthusiastically this identification of Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson for pretty nearly opposite reasons. So many words, Trump has said, I'm like Andrew Jackson, I'm a wonderful guy. And his critics have said, yeah, you are just like Andrew Jackson.
You're a terrible guy.
You're just as terrible as he was.
Well, I guess it all depends on how you look at Jackson, doesn't it?
Well, one of the interesting and frankly to me appalling things is that on both sides, both sides have played fast and loose with Jackson himself.
Competing versions of reality. Now, there's a concept.
Well, competing erroneous versions of reality. Mm-hmm. Really what's happened is Donald Trump invited us to view himself through the lens of Andrew Jackson. And what both sides have done is to view Andrew Jackson through the lens of Donald Trump. So Trump celebrates Jackson for things that Jackson did not do. And his critics criticize Jackson for wildly exaggerated to the point of falsified versions of things that he did do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of those falsehoods and those exaggerations.
Well, which side do you want to start?
Let's start with the president and his supporters.
The president and his supporters. Donald Trump has portrayed Andrew Jackson as a kind of fearless champion of the people, admirably unrestrained.
Mm-hmm.
In his willingness to go outside of conventional norms and break things up and smash things up. At the Hermitage, actually, the president ticked off things in which he said he was just like Andrew Jackson. For instance, he celebrated Andrew Jackson's so-called spoil system, though we didn't call it by that name, of cleaning out the federal bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And the president actually said something like, see what's coming, folks.
Mm-hmm. So he said that Jackson was willing to give his friends political appointments.
Yep.
To the victor go the spoils.
He didn't put it that way, but it's not who you put in, but who you clear out. You're going to clear out the
deadwood or the deep state, as he likes to call them.
That's right. Just as Jackson talked about cleansing the Augean stables,
mm-hmm.
Trump has talked about cleaning out the deep state. Interestingly, and this was kind of a DNA marker on where the president was getting his notions about Andrew Jackson. He said that Andrew Jackson raised tariffs on foreign goods in order to protect American workers. And, of course, Donald Trump, was going to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
I say it's an interesting marker because that was not Jackson's policy.
What was Jackson's policy on tariffs?
Well, as with everything, there's a little complexity.
Sure, go ahead.
Jackson came into office as a defender of moderate protection meaning tariffs deliberately imposed on certain goods in order to raise their price, mainly British manufactured goods.
Wasn't
at this time
a little bit unusual for Southern slave owner, because weren't they typically the people who wanted to consume those products and therefore wouldn't like tariffs?
That was certainly true of some Southern slaveholders. Jackson's, mm-hmm. I would say his framing political principles were not those of a Southern slaveholder, though he was a Southern slaveholder, but mm-hmm. but those of a Unionist and a Nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson had been a moderate advocate of a protective tariff ever since his experiences as a general during the War of 1812. And he explicitly framed it on grounds of national independence, and that is the United States might have to fight another war with Great Britain or somebody. We ought to be able at least to have the capacity to produce what we needed to fight a war and have the ability to move it around the country.
Exactly.
And that means protective tariff and a transportation policy.
But for those people who glaze over whenever economic terms are mentioned, the idea here is that you raise taxes basically on things you're importing, like British goods, manufactured goods,
yep.
And then that gives a competitive advantage to homegrown manufacturers, mostly in the north, mostly in the northeast. So the southerners weren't into that. The northerners tended to be. But Jackson, as you say, was a nationalist, and he wanted basically a homegrown armaments industry.
Yes.
Something that could support the Army and the Navy in the future.
It's not only armaments. Mm-hmm. It's everything.
Right.
Henry Clay basically made some of the same argument, emphasized the military side of it a little bit less. But anyway, that's when Jackson came into office. After about 2 years, he reversed himself on this and favored what he called a tariff for revenue, which means reduce the tariff to the point where it's barely at a level to meet necessary federal expenditures, because a protective tariff would actually bring in more money than the federal government needed. Hmm. And then the question is how you spend the surplus. And Jackson, after very precisely in 1831, reversed himself on this and said the tariff ought to come down to its merely a revenue standard. Remember, there's no income tax at this time.
Right.
The United States is getting about 90% of its annual revenues from the tariff. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, Jackson distanced himself somewhat from the whole tariff debate and said, and I think most economic historians today would say, correctly said, both of you, the people on both sides of this issue are exaggerating its importance. To my fellow Southerners, if you have economic difficulties, the tariff isn't really the cause of them. And to Northerners, the tariff is not as essential to your well-being as you think it is. He distanced himself from this and still tried to look at it. I think Jackson's fundamental view consistently is, from his point of view, what's best for the country. And by a couple years into his presidency, he thought what was best for the country was simply to compromise the tariff issue because the actual issue was less important than the political damage it was doing.
This actually had led to the nullification crisis.
Led to the nullification crisis, on which Jackson absolutely defended the tariff against the charge that a federal tariff was unconstitutional, which is a flimsy case, but it had been made.
Well, notably South Carolina, where the port of Charleston was, they basically said, we are not going to enforce or allow federal officials to enforce this tariff because we're a sovereign state, and by golly, you can't make us do it.
Yep.
And Jackson took exception to that, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I don't want to get too much diverted into this, but the point is that Jackson arrived at his position of opposing protective tariffs through a series of steps. He didn't come into office with that.
Okay.
He actually, on a lot of economic policies, his position evolved. But by the end of his administration, the Democratic Party was the party of low tariffs and low federal expenditures and opposed to the internal improvement policy, that's federal transportation spending, which is where you would spend the money from surplus tariff revenues. And that remained the Democratic Party's identity all the way through the 19th century. The tariff kept coming back up. It became a big issue again in the late 19th century, in the so-called Gilded Age. And always the Democratic Party was, generally speaking, the party of low tariffs. That's all the way true down into the early 20th century. So when President Trump got up there and said Andrew Jackson wanted to raise tariffs or did raise tariffs on foreign goods to protect American workers, you're going, you know, what?
It was almost exactly the opposite.
Yeah. There were two historians, me and another guy, in that crowd, and it was an interesting crowd. And we just looked at each other like, how could he possibly say that?
You said it's an interesting crowd. What was interesting about it?
Well, it was partly Nashville people and supporters of the Hermitage, and they don't wear a partisan flag on their sleeve, but the Nashville establishment is largely a Democratic establishment. But the president's supporters, including some state legislators, had turned out to cheer on the president. So we were kind of surrounded by people in a sea of MAGA hats.
Right.
Today I call attention to another anniversary, the 250th birthday of the very great Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson is the one president who has been most often compared to being Trump-like, or shall I say Andrew Jackson-like.
The president really is fond of President Jackson.
I think President Trump, as the most unconventional president in our history, is looking for some historical parallel that I think grounds him to some extent in the experience of the country.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with my buddy, Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee, and we're evaluating those comparisons between Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson and whether they're really accurate. This is your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today my guest is Dan Feller, a historian from the University of Tennessee, and we've been talking about comparisons between Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson. One of them on tariffs that turns out not to be that accurate.
So that's one version, and I can tell you where I think the president got that from, though.
Please.
There is a kind of scholar pundit type in Washington, D.C., a guy named Walter Russell Mead, who is sometimes branded as a historian, but he's not. And he's a kind of freelance interdisciplinary scholar. I'm not sure what his actual disciplinary home is. Mm-hmm. But he writes broadly on American politics, in particular foreign policy. And way back in 1999 or 2000, he published an article called The Jacksonian Tradition, which he then later developed into a book. And in the article and the book, he argued that there are four tropes in American foreign policy that relate to four either aspects of the American character or constituencies within the American polity. They were somewhat ambiguous on what they are, which it is. And one of them is the Jacksonian. And he argued that Jacksonians are, you might say, people of the heartland. They're not the coastal elites.
The flyover people.
They're the flyover people. And he argued that culturally, Jacksonians are very protective of family and clan, suspicious of outsiders, not quite isolationists, but very much anti-internationalists, mm-hmm. People who basically look at the world as if it was a bunch of families writ large, and your primary objective has to be to take care of your own.
Okay.
And so they're very much opposed to multinational agreements. They're anti-UN.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're anti, what was the George W. Bush phrase, New World Order. New World Order.
This is all sounding very familiar.
Yeah, they view international relations fundamentally as a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of who wins and who loses. They are therefore very much opposed to not only to multinational agreements, but to foreign aid, which they think is a waste. On the other hand, they love military spending. They love the military.
Mm-hmm.
They love guns. And they believe that if the United States does get in a war, the way we should fight it is just kill them all and get out of there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And one could go on with this, and you, from a critical eye, you realize that the Jacksonians are what many people think are, you know, he's describing Donald Trump's constituency.
Yeah.
And remember, published it in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early part of Trump's administration and before Trump's administration, it was given out to the news media that the president was studying up on Andrew Jackson.
And so that's the version of Jackson he studied up on.
That's the version of, one strongly suspects that's the version of Andrew Jackson that Steve Bannon
right.
studied up on. And when I said a DNA marker earlier,
that was it.
You would never, by actually reading anything about Andrew Jackson, a biography or a study of his administration, get the idea that Andrew Jackson was a champion of higher tariffs, of tariff protection. But you would get exactly that idea by reading Walter Russell meet.
Okay. So you saw where it came from, and it was not a very reliable source.
It was not a very reliable source. The one thing, reading this simply as a scholar, you say there were some ambiguities in the article. Professor Mead, he is a professor, had read widely in the literature on Jacksonian America, but more as a consumer than as a, you know, than an on-hands researcher. And so he had read a lot of books and tried to amalgamate what he found in those books into a single thesis. And if you know the literature, you're saying, wait, this doesn't fit. You know,
okay.
you got this book and that book, and you're talking about as if they agree with each other, and they don't. But leaving that aside and leaving also the ambiguity of, is he talking about aspects of American character, or is he talking about a constituency? Because he went back and forth on that. The one thing he never explained is why he calls this Jacksonian. And there was an emphasis in it on foreign policy, and what you would get from this is that Andrew Jackson's foreign policy consisted of warmongering, brandishing, you know.
And that was not true.
No, basically it's not true.
Most of his war fighting happened before he was president, right?
Yeah, correct.
Right.
And in fact, with the one old enemy, the traditional enemy, the British, not only the American traditional enemy, but Andrew Jackson's personal enemy. These are the people who killed off his family.
Mm-hmm. He fought in the Revolution as a teenager.
The Revolution as a pre-teenager.
Mm.
But more than that, his family were Irish immigrants. And if you read the authorized today, we would say, biography of Jackson, first full biography, published by his good friend and military aide and later his Secretary of War, John Henry Eaton. Literally, the first paragraph is about how Jackson grew up at his mother's knee, imbibing stories of British atrocities.
Oh, my.
And in fact, when Jackson became president, the British government was going to go, oh, boy, you know, here we go. His policy, I don't think we want to get into the details, toward Britain was remarkably conciliatory, much more conciliatory than that of his immediate predecessor, John Quincy Adams.
So to bring it back to Trump seems to have been influenced perhaps through Steve Bannon.
Yep.
By this fellow named Mead,
yep.
Whose scholarship, in your opinion, is not particularly in-depth or accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so has come up with an inaccurate version of who Jackson was and what his policies were. So that takes care of Trump's self-comparison to Jackson, or at least part of it. What about the people on the other side? What about the Democrats?
The people on the other side, and I think most of them are Democrats, though it is mainly media people. They're certainly anti-Trump people, that they would not deny, have imbibed the negative side of the Andrew Jackson stereotype.
Right.
As a guy who wanted to slaughter all the Indians, as a guy who went around shooting people left and right, as a guy whose policies were merely wanton explosions of personal spleen.
that does seem to capture at least the popular conception of Jackson.
Let me demolish those.
Okay, please. By
briefly,
all means.
And to show you how supposedly reliable venues these have appeared in. During the 2016 campaign, The Atlantic Magazine, which is a respected opinion journal, ran a cover story on, at that time, candidate Trump, which president was he most like? I think all these comparisons are silly anyway. You know, who's just like who? Well, nobody's just like anybody. But
many people compare me to Brad Pitt.
So that's funny.
It's hard to tell us apart.
Yeah, I look exactly like my younger brother, who looks exactly like Paul Newman.
We
won't go any further.
All right.
And it was a professor of psychology at Northwestern University who actually wrote this cover story. And if you want to respect either Northwestern University or the discipline of psychology, don't read this article. And which he said, Donald Trump is just like Andrew Jackson because they have violent characters. And Andrew Jackson fought 14 duels. And I'm looking at this, and I think 14, you know.
You must have missed a few, huh?
We missed 13 of them. and shortly after that, Newsweek, which at that point I think was only an online venue, and, you know, I think they may be printing again now, but Newsweek came out with a piece by a so-called senior editor saying that Jackson fought 100 duels.
100 duels.
Nobody fought 100 duels. Nobody fought 14 duels.
You'd have to be pretty good at it.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah.
I think I know at least as much history as the people who are making these claims. I don't know anybody who fought more than five duels, and five is out there. You know, you only had to fight two to get a reputation as a duelist.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson, in fact, fought one that was a lulu of a duel. And I do not mean to say that Jackson was not a violent character, because he was.
Maybe. Was that the one where he's having the running gun fight in the streets of Nashville?
No, that's not a duel.
Oh, okay. That was just a running gun fight.
That
okay.
was just a running gun fight. Yeah. There was a running gun fight in the streets of Nashville.
Okay.
The one duel is the one where against a young man named Charles Dickinson, where Dickinson plunked Jackson, shot Jackson first. Jackson held his fire and then killed Dickinson. It's an amazing duel. We talked about it mm-hmm. before. But it is only one duel. Not to say that Jackson wasn't willing to fight more, not to say he wasn't involved in other kinds of fights. But 14 is just out there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we know, though this professor who wrote the article didn't know, where he got the number 14.
Where'd he get him?
There was an anti-Jackson pamphlet published in 1828 during the campaign for the mm-hmm. presidency, published anonymously. By a guy who said, it's like a 10-page pamphlet, something like that. And the guy said, I've been digging around Jackson's past, and I've come up with all these episodes. And he listed 14 of them. And the thing is, only one of them's a duel. But
okay.
there is that number 14, and I don't think that's coincidence. And in fact, later on, at the end of the article, he said, you know, there's probably 100 more. And that's where the number 100 comes from also. So
this is sounding like very sloppy journalism.
It's very sloppy journalism. First, we have this idea that Jackson went around shooting everybody. Indian removal, the Indian removal policy, which you don't need to exaggerate in order to condemn if that's your, you know, inclination, nonetheless has been exaggerated. The New York Times actually said that Jackson's policy annihilated the Southeastern Indians. Now, annihilated is a word with a particular meaning,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't, you know.
He was an Indian fighter, though.
Yes, mm-hmm. but did Patton annihilate the Germans? I mean,
mm-hmm. right.
when you're fighting a war, you're supposed to kill people.
Right.
No question that Jackson killed Indians.
Right.
It was not true that the Indian removal policy as president was designed to kill Indians. We could talk about why some Indians died, and we can blame the policy for that, but it was not a deliberately genocidal or homicidal policy, and it certainly did not annihilate the Indians. I mean, it may have done terrible things to them, but there are still Cherokees around.
So he was an aggressive and competent general, but he wasn't as bloodthirsty or as bigoted as people are sometimes claiming?
Yeah, we'll use that.
Okay.
And the other thing, this gets more into policy stuff. Oh, Jackson, you know, wanted to wage war on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's just not true. His campaign against the Bank of the United States has been singled out as showing his caprice.
Again, people get a little bit glazed over. The second Bank of the United States we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Is a precursor, in some sense, to what we now call the Federal Reserve. It's a central bank that has some...
Alert. Precursor uh-huh. in very, very limited ways.
Okay, I'm simply trying to give it the broadest possible understanding. It's a bank that the United States, to some extent, controlled. It's a bank that the United States government could turn to if it needed capital quickly. Example, if there was a war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bank because it controlled its own banknotes, which were close to being a standard across the country, did have some significant impact on the money supply and interest rates. And those are all functions of a central bank. Now, it was a very different institution, and it did represent in many people's minds the concentration of Eastern money power that people didn't like. Is that a fair statement about how people perceive this?
Yes. Let me amend it a little bit.
Okay.
The bank was, it was the government's banker, and mm-hmm. that's why it was created
right.
by Congress with a charter yes,
right.
in 1816. A charter that in return for the bank's performance of government functions, and it really performed not only a lot of the functions of the Federal Reserve, but a lot of the functions of the United States Treasury today.
Mm-hmm.
It did issue banknotes which were a legal tender for debts to the United States government, which made them, in effect, the paper money supply of the country.
Right.
Yes, it brokered the federal government's loans. It, without charge, received, held, and dispersed federal funds so that when customs revenues are collected, for instance, at New York City. They're deposited in the local bank, branch of the Bank of the United States. And if those funds need then to be sent out west to pay the troops on the frontier, the federal government, the Bank of the United States did that. It moved all the government's money around.
Right.
In return for that, it was granted exclusive privileges, and those are the exact words, in the charter. The important thing about it is this, and this is the way in which it is nothing like the Federal Reserve. It was a private bank.
Yep.
It was a private commercial bank. It did over-the-counter banking business in competition with other banks and to its own profit. Now, it operated under a congressional charter. It had headquarters in Philadelphia, but it could establish branches, and it had established branches in 20 of them around the country.
Mm-hmm.
This time, there's no other bank that operates outside a single state, because every other bank was incorporated under state laws.
Right.
And most banks, in fact, only had one office. It was incorporated with a capital of $35 million. This is at a time when the annual federal budget in its entirety, including debt service, ran around $20 to $25 million.
Wow. We're talking trillions of dollars in today's times.
Well, yeah, it's hard to do the equivalences, mm-hmm. but yes, a huge capital.
And we're turning this all over to private investors.
Well, yes, essentially. Under the bank's charter, the United States government owned 1/5 of the stock. So the United States government owned $7 million worth out of the 35. And bank was to be run by a board of directors of 25 people, five of whom were to be appointed by the President of the United States with consent of the Senate. The others were privately elected. The bank made profits. It paid dividends. And there was always an implicit, at least, danger that the private interests of the bank and its stockholders would conflict with its public responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. And you can see that. You can see that potential.
You can see that potential. And in fact, as the volumes of the Jackson Papers abundantly show, that was not merely potential. That was actual. I mean,
okay.
I can give you cases where the Bank of the United States deliberately did things to increase its profits and cost the federal government money. And this is the thing that gets left out when we make these comparisons. But that the reason it's so insidious that it gets left out is this is precisely Jackson's objection to it in vetoing the bank. In particular, in a famous line that I probably quoted to you before, in the middle of his bank veto, vetoing a recharter bill in 1832, Jackson said, "It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes."
Oh, my.
Namely, this charter, while it may or may not be of, the bank may or may not be useful to the United States, in particular, it is enriching a handful of the bank stockholders, which there is no question that it did.
And just giving them too much power over the finances of the United States.
The bank, in fact, had the ability, as it soon showed, to engender a nationwide
financial panic yeah,
anytime it wanted to, in order to serve its own political interests, which, in fact, it did.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a fascinating discussion about, of all things, the Second Bank of the United States and Andrew Jackson's policies regarding it. I'm speaking with Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee, and we're comparing Andrew Jackson to Donald Trump. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Dan Feller, a University of Tennessee historian and the editor and director of the Papers of Andrew Jackson.
Okay, let's just bring it back to Trump then. So people on the left are characterizing him as being what? Anti-banking? Anti-elite? Anti...
Well, the way this is characterized on the left is that the Bank of the United States was a pinnacle of rectitude, mm-hmm. just as we hope the Federal Reserve is,
mm-hmm.
you know, apolitical,
okay.
screened off from any
political.
And here Jackson, because he hates the president of the Bank of the United States, comes in and recklessly busts it up.
Okay, now I see where you're going with this and why you were so at pains to point out the difference. The Fed was created much later, decades later, mm-hmm. and it certainly involves private banks and appointees, but it is a quasi-governmental entity. It's got a certain independence. Its governors are appointed for a term of years, and they can't be dismissed except for malfeasance of that sort. So it's deliberately designed to be independent, and as you say, an institution of rectitude, which has a dual charge to keep interest rates at a certain level and keep employment at a certain level.
And notice what's not in that charge.
Fiscal policy.
Well, no. Making a profit for its stockholders.
Oh, okay. Exactly right.
There are no stockholders.
Yeah, exactly. It does not have a conflict of interest built into it.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
Exactly.
So Trump's attitude toward the central bank these days is not at all connected really to Jackson's attitude toward the Second Bank of the United States.
I would say not connected at all.
Okay. There's
a certain irony that you can hear today criticisms of, not of the Federal Reserve, but of the control of bankers over American policy and the complaint that the rich and powerful, and that was Jackson's phrase, and you can hear this complaint today using those exact totemic words. Mm-hmm. That the rich and powerful behind closed doors are writing legislation to their benefit, to your detriment, which not only perhaps may influence your fortunes negatively, but that controls your lives. You know, that we are all being played mm-hmm. by a group of selfish, greedy people whose wealth and power enable them to write the laws. That's pretty much what Jackson was saying, and he had some good reason for saying it. That's also what certain presidential candidates are saying right now, mm-hmm. Donald Trump not being among them. Mm-hmm. And it's very...
So he seems to be the polar opposite of Jackson is what you're saying.
I'm not sure polar opposite. I would say that the people who now... Nothing is exactly the same, so I don't want to say that these people are exactly the same as Andrew Jackson. But if you find a common thread there, the common thread that I just announced. The person today who sounds much like and most like Andrew Jackson, and at times startlingly like Andrew Jackson, is
Bernie.
Elizabeth Warren.
Well,
even more than Bernie?
More
than Bernie, because Elizabeth Warren made that, and this is actually the thing, if you go back to around 2014, is one of the things that vaulted her into
into
kind of the A-list of potential mm-hmm. presidential candidates was her attack on banking legislation that was being written behind closed doors to eviscerate the banking reforms that have been imposed after 2008. Mm-hmm. And she has used, as a matter of fact, in practically every sentence, the phrase rich and powerful to make pretty much Jackson's same complaint. And that is, and to say, and they both said this in very similar words, is this a democracy or not? If it's a democracy, who speaks for the common people? Is this country run by you and me?
Good heavens.
Or is it run by bankers?
So Elizabeth Warren is the most Jacksonian candidate right now, at least when it comes to financial matters.
From that narrow point of view, yes. Huh? So to come back to it, you read or you see or you hear Andrew Jackson's name come up mm-hmm. you know, pretty constantly nowadays. And unfortunately, I know I sound like one of those, you know, academics, it's a little more complicated than that. Well, it is.
It is. And by the way, just for the record, I don't think Elizabeth Warren has fought any duels either. So this is strictly in the financial area.
Almost everything you see about Andrew Jackson is at very least exaggerated and just often flat out wrong. And this is because we are not looking at Jackson with, you might say, neutral eyes. We've got a point to prove. Mm-hmm. Whatever that point may be, as I said, we view Andrew Jackson through the lens of Donald Trump. So if Donald Trump is a capricious jerk, which some people think he is, then Andrew Jackson must have been a capricious jerk too. If Donald Trump is a champion of the American workers and thus going to show all those foreign countries who's boss, and Andrew Jackson must have done the same.
Very, very interesting. You know, this actually reminds me of Ronald Reagan. I mean, certainly Republicans have mythologized Reagan, and even some Democrats will make references to him frequently. And of course, every Republican candidate likes to compare himself to Reagan in a positive way, whereas Democrats will point out that he was actually far more liberal than the current crop of Republicans out there, and he might not even be welcome into their increasingly small tent. Mm-hmm. So you pick a person, a historical person, You mythologize that person, you shade that person's reputation, and then you use it to compare yourself in a favorable way and your opponent in an unfavorable way.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening with Jackson right
now.
That's
what's happening with Jackson.
And it drives people like you just crazy.
It does drive people like me crazy. Let me give one more example. In 1834, Jackson was censured by the United States Senate. And he was censured for something, and he wasn't censured for other things.
Okay. What was he censured for?
He was censured for, let me read you. This is the entire resolution of censure.
I wish people could see you right now because the look of anticipation and amusement on your face is palpable, but go on.
This is the resolution of censure from beginning to end. Resolved that the president in the late executive proceedings in relation to the public revenue has assumed upon himself authority and power not conferred by the Constitution and laws, but in derogation of both.
My.
Now, you would think that somebody who is going to write about what Jackson was censured for would read that sentence, because that's the whole thing. You know, again, this is not a censure that's preceded by 10 volumes of whereases.
Right.
There's no committee report behind it. It's one sentence.
And what prompted it? What was a specific transgression?
That's a very good question. You, even if you do read it, admittedly, you know, the president in the late executive proceedings in relation to the public revenue, what does that mean? What it means was Jackson's, after he vetoed the bank recharter, removing the federal government's deposits, in effect, from the Bank of the United States. Mm-hmm. As I said, the bank was the government's own banker. So the United States government had its own account with the bank.
And that was considered to be beyond his power as president.
Yes, in a very interesting way. In the law, and the law we're talking about is actually the bank charter, which is a law passed by Congress, an act of incorporation. It said that the Secretary of the Treasury had the power to remove the deposits if he explained his reasons to Congress immediately or as soon as possible. So the power to remove them was there, but it was specifically given by law to the Secretary of the Treasury, and not accidentally. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that in 1833, and all this is covered in the volume of the Papers of Andrew Jackson that is going to be published this afternoon.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Jackson, after canvassing his cabinet, there was nothing hasty about this, decided that he wanted to remove the federal deposits from the Bank of the United States, only his Secretary of the Treasury wouldn't do it.
Oh.
And so Jackson fired him, replaced him with another man as Secretary of the Treasury who was a big advocate of doing it. That man is Roger Taney, who was later...
Chief Justice.
Chief Justice, yeah. And Taney then issued the order. Quite happily.
Right.
So then the question that the Senate had to deal with is, if you give specific powers to the Secretary of the Treasury, and then the President of the United States
undermines that.
Yes. You know, is that out of bounds? And of course, there was partisanship all over this, but still, the majority of the Senate voted that it was.
And censured him. They didn't remove him. He hadn't been impeached, and he wasn't being tried.
He had not been impeached, and again, here we have to look at the party dynamics of it. There was an anti-Jackson majority in the Senate. There was not an anti-Jackson majority in the House.
This is just so reminiscent of recent events, isn't it?
It is so reminiscent with this one...
Again, we don't want to fall in the trap of making too close a comparison.
Let me make a comparison, actually, because people sometimes have trouble understanding this. You know, Secretary of the Treasury, President, whatever. Mm-hmm. At that time, and this goes all the way back to the American Revolution and Americans' fears of undivided executive power, mm-hmm. the power of the purse and the power of the sword in one person's mm-hmm. hands, which they had very carefully taken out of the King of England's hands. Mm-hmm. Both powers are in the executive branch of the United States, at least to a certain extent. When certain powers were given or certain authorities to the Secretary of the Treasury, the idea was to mitigate by partially at least separating mm-hmm. the power of the purse from the person of the president. The analogy I make is... And it's only a partial analogy, but I think it has validity this far. Today, we are used to the idea, which has not always been there, that the Attorney General, while he serves or she might serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States, mm-hmm. is supposed to have certain functions that should be
somewhat independent.
Somewhat independent.
And that's since John Mitchell went to federal prison back in the 70s.
I would say since Watergate, yeah.
Exactly, since Watergate. But here's the interesting constitutional thing. Congress, in the first instance, has the power of the purse. It raises taxes. It spends money. But we're talking about money that's already being held by the national government, and that's in the Treasury. Mm-hmm. And so an executive officer, the Treasurer of the United States, cabinet member, actually has day-to-day control over that. So you're saying that Congress tried to delegate this specific power of withdrawal to that specific cabinet officer. Okay, so far so good. But then he works for the president. And so the president can fire him. This sounds like the Saturday Night Massacre is what it sounds like back during the Nixon administration.
Yep.
And it also sounds very reminiscent of what's going on with Attorney General Barr. And the people who are doing this, including Barr, have this strange thing they call the unitary theory of the presidency, that all power of the executive is in the president. And so it's perfectly okay for him to order people around and to investigate his political enemies. Or to do as Trump himself said last July, I believe, you know, Article 2 says, I can do whatever I want. That's where we are now, but that's what got Andrew Jackson in trouble.
That is, in a way, I would say that at least within certain limits, Jackson would have subscribed
okay.
to the unitary theory. And indeed, in a paper that he read to his cabinet and then immediately had published right before the confrontation, really, with his Secretary of the Treasury, Jackson said something to that effect. He kind of went back and forth as a very squeamish closing to the thing where he says, look, on the one hand, I'm not ordering you, but it's...
But kind of, maybe.
But it's important that an administration have harmony and unity and that the president be, you know... So you could see this... You could see how both sides would have an argument here. Jackson's argument yeah. is, look, this is administration policy and these people serve me. The argument of his people, his opponents in the Senate, which has its own validity, is we, Congress, gave this authority to the Secretary of the Treasury, not to the president. Those words mean something if we had meant this power
you're not,
to be—
You're not executing the law that we passed.
That's right. If we had meant the president to have this authority, then we would have said that in the law, and that's not what the law said.
And it's our power to determine how the money is spent or how the money is used, and it goes back to our power of the purse.
Hey, but beyond that, mm-hmm. Short of that, maybe— The president shouldn't be allowed to make de facto blank paper out of a law.
Understood. But, you know, I think we may finally have come up with something where there is a great comparison to be made, because Jackson wanted harmony within his administration, which means harmony, people singing his tune, what he called, whereas this president now, especially since his acquittal in the Senate, seems to be cleaning house. Much as Jackson said he would do, and is going to assert much greater day-to-day control over lots and lots of decisions. At least that seems to be what's happening already. Now, that seems pretty Jacksonian. Tell me I'm wrong.
I would say that I see no parallel in the degree of vindictiveness.
Okay. Which one's the more vindictive?
Oh, definitely Donald Trump.
Okay.
Jackson had an ability. Now, I won't say he did this all the time, but this is one of the things that he is accused of never doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is of segmenting. I won't say that he had a distinctive capacity for it, but he did it the way many people do, you know. Mm-hmm. That is, he could tolerate, in fact, opposition within his administration. He tolerated opposition to removal of the deposits from a couple of his cabinet officers. In mm-hmm. fact, a couple of them came to him and said, you know, we oppose this policy. You want us to acquit? And Jackson said, no. You run your department. I asked for your opinion. You said you opposed it. I'm going to do it anyway. We're fine.
He didn't have them marched out by the security team.
That's right. Now, except for the Secretary of the Treasury.
He did get that. Okay.
Because he wanted the policy implemented. But mm-hmm. going back to what we talked about earlier, Jackson grew up hating the British. You're president of the United States. If you're a responsible person, you learn how to park things.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to park that. He was able to park some personal animosities from his own past. And famously, he was able to park his animosity to Thomas Hart Benton, who had earlier in their careers shot him.
Was that the running gunfight or was that the duel?
That was the running gunfight.
Running gunfight. Well, again, people who want to hear that story can go to work.
So my point is not that Jackson was a pacifistic guy, which he was not, but there were restraints, there were limits, there were qualifications, and now we talk about him as just as if he was armed to the teeth, raging around the White House, you know, screaming obscenities at everybody. He just didn't do that.
Tweeting at all hours of the night.
Yeah. I'd also say along the same thing that one of the threads here, one of criticism of Jackson, is that he didn't really know what he was doing, that it's all based on personal animosity.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it wasn't.
And you think perhaps with this president it is?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay.
I'm not going to, but I would say it definitely wasn't with Jackson. For instance, he did come to hate the president of the Bank of the United States, Nicholas Biddle. Biddle had some things that made him very hateable, but that...
I'm sorry, I want to hear about all that. I think we're going to have to leave it there, Dan, because we're running out of time. So to bring it back to our original...
Let me just say, Jackson's political hatreds were usually, while they certainly existed, they were the consequence of political disagreements. They weren't the cause of them.
Well, Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee, the editor and director of the Papers of Andrew Jackson. What a fascinating discussion we've had today. Really, really fascinating. If you want to hear more about this, go to our podcast site. Go to the search bar, enter Jackson or Feller, F-E-L-L-E-R, Dan's last name. And you'll come up with those two episodes where you're going to get a panoramic view of Andrew Jackson's life. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Dan Feller.
Thank you for having me.
Following its drafting at the Pennsylvania State House, the U.S. Constitution encountered a year-long battle over ratification between the Federalist and Anti-Federalist factions. Leading the Federalists were James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton, each of whom authored several essays in strong support of ratification, collectively known as the Federalist Papers. Leading the Anti-Federalists were Patrick Henry, George Mason, and Thomas Jefferson. The Anti-Federalists were wary of a strong central government becoming too tyrannical. They also believed that a constitution without an enumeration of individual rights would allow the government to trample on the rights of the citizen. The first state to ratify the Constitution was Delaware. However, the debate focused intensely on the states of New York and Virginia, and both state legislatures voted for ratification. New Hampshire was the last necessary state to ratify the Constitution. This is Tyler Stanley with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks to my buddy Dan Feller, and thanks to WUOT, which volunteered its studios once again for this interview. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.